From the studios of 88.9 KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Stanley Weintraub is my guest. He's written so many books that to mention each one would take the whole show. He's an historian, biographer, an expert on George Bernard Shaw, and a chronicler of the 20th century. His latest book is Final Victory, FDR's Extraordinary World War II Presidential Campaign. Stanley Weintraub, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Dr. Weintraub, do you personally have memories of the 1944 campaign? You were a kid then.
Yes, I do. I was in high school at the time, very interested in politics. I had been interested since 1940, in fact, when I was really just a small kid, when Wendell Willkie ran against Roosevelt for the third term. Willkie turned out to be a very formidable candidate, and Roosevelt was expecting in the fourth term that he might even meet Willkie again. But Willkie was too liberal and too internationalist for the Republican majority, and he was blocked out of contention. Perhaps fortunately, because Willkie died of a heart attack a month before the election.
Oh, huh. That would have been interesting.
Yeah. He was a heavy drinker, and it affected his heart. And no one, of course, knew that he was a heavy drinker because the press was so much more reticent back then, as we know from the 1944 election and the problems of Roosevelt's health.
Right. Well, you know, most little kids are not that interested in politics today. Were they then, or were you just a strange guy?
I think I was a strange guy. I was a call it a premature historian. I wanted to write. World War II was ongoing.
Yes.
In Europe in 1940, and I was 11 years old, and I thought I could write a history of the war as it was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that what the newspapers published and what the radio was allowed to report didn't necessarily mean that that was what was really happening. And when I realized that I was stymied, my history ended. But I kept my interest in the war. Pearl Harbor, of course, and the next year made it that much more dramatic. And then 1940 came along, and at that point, I was well aware of what was going on in high school.
Well, the press was so much different then than it is now. I mean, I think I can remember the turning point possibly being when I heard about President Carter's hemorrhoids. You know, and once the press is telling you all that, then I guess, you know, a president who couldn't walk, and he was, you know, I always thought when I was growing up that President Roosevelt couldn't walk, but people didn't mind.
They didn't even
but
know
they actually
in many
didn't
cases,
know.
Because radio was the preeminent way in which people found out information other than the daily newspaper that came to their front door. Radio was real. Print was not. Radio was what was happening at the time, and you lent your imagination to radio. Which you can't really do with television. Television is there for you. It sets the table for you. But with radio, you imagine things. And President Roosevelt was a master radio broadcaster. He had a resonant voice. He appealed to people. He gave what he called fireside chats from the beginning of his first administration in 1933. The fireside chats were meant to suggest that he was talking to you in your home, at your fireside, from his fireside. And, of course, you didn't have a fireside, and he was speaking from his Oval Office. So it was all a make-believe. But nevertheless, it worked, and he gave dozens of fireside chats over the years, and they resonated with people. They clicked with him, and it didn't occur to them that he had been crippled with polio since 1921.
And did the newspapers not print that? Did they just avoid that? Or
they ignored it. They ignored it because Roosevelt appeared at press conferences at the Oval Office, sitting behind his desk, and chatted with the reporters. He had nearly 1,000 press conferences during his 3-plus terms as president. And he was always seated at his desk, which is what was appropriate for him. He didn't try to get up on his crutches or on his braces. He didn't even have a conventional wheelchair. President Roosevelt used an old kitchen chair that had bicycle wheels attached to it. It's hard to imagine that, especially as far away as you are right now. If you go to Washington, you can go to the Roosevelt Memorial, and as you walk in, you will see a statue of Roosevelt sitting in his wheelchair, sitting, in effect, in this kitchen chair with the bicycle wheels. It's remarkable. It's astounding. But this is how this is how he got away with the fact that he was immobilized, that he could not use his legs. No one really cared. People knew that he went to Warm Springs in Georgia every summer in order to bathe in the healing waters for his legs, but it didn't occur to them that this immobilized him, because he was a very active person. And in 1936, this, of course, is before my memories, but this actually happened, the presidential nominating convention was in Philadelphia that year for the Democrats, and Roosevelt, on his braces, being helped by someone to make a speech, fell face forward. The only time it's ever been recorded that he fell on his braces. Someone took a picture, a newsman took a picture of his being sprawled on the floor. It never made the press, never made the newspapers, wasn't printed for decades afterwards. And the only way you can see it now is if you go to the museum in Washington, where they have a picture of it on display.
So there was just a kind of an agreement not to expose this, or?
Well, it was a gentleman's agreement, if you want to call it that. That's a cliche, but it really works. It was agreed in politics that a lot of things that would have been catastrophic to people's reputations were not mentioned.
Like Wilkie's drinking and so forth?
Like Wilkie's drinking. President Warren Harding had two mistresses, for example.
Only two?
Only two recorded mistresses, put it that way. There were stories and rumors about a lot of other politicians, and they didn't make the papers, they didn't make the radio, and television finally got to some of them, and the Internet, of course, has now made that kind of spurious privacy almost impossible.
Oh, it was a different world in 1944. Stanley Weintraub, you mentioned the memorial to President Roosevelt in Washington, and I believe his little dog Fala is at that memorial too.
But, yes, he is.
But that's a memorial that, according to your book, President Roosevelt would not have wanted.
Roosevelt did not want a memorial. He wanted a block of granite, a simple block of granite that gave his name and his dates, and that was all. But of course, once you're dead, you have no control over your reputation and how it's memorialized.
I guess he finally lost control once he left the earth.
Yes. And during his time, though, he had great control, partly because he was so respected by the press, and partly because he was able to manipulate his own reputation, his own sense of what the presidency was. Even though he was quite ill, he didn't know how sick he was. He wanted to project in 1944 that he was an active president and commander-in-chief of the armed forces. At the time of the presidential nominating convention in Chicago in 44, He deliberately wasn't there. He wanted to pretend that he was not involved in politics. He went instead to Camp Pendleton, California, to watch the maneuvers of Marines who were practicing to invade Japan. And I begin my book there because he had what apparently was a heart attack there, which was hidden. The only person present was his Marine officer son, James. And he told James, put me down on the floor. He was in his railway car. Put me down on the floor and let me rest. He rested a bit and he said, okay, pick me up and we'll go out and visit the Marines. And they went out, his convertible Packard, which came with on the train. He always used the convertible so he could be seen. They went out and they saw the Marines. He made a radio talk from his train after that, and then got on a cruiser and went to Pearl Harbor.
So he had a heart attack, but he just ignored it.
He ignored it, and the press didn't know about it.
So he was, not only was he being elected to his fourth term, which no other president had faced, and not only could he not walk, but he was literally at death's door.
He was much sicker than he knew. His personal physician was Vice Admiral Ross McIntyre, who was the Surgeon General of the Navy. But Ross McIntyre didn't really cope with Roosevelt's health. He went to see him and sprayed his sinuses once a day because he had problems with his sinuses. McIntyre was an ENT man, ear, nose, and throat. Well, that was McIntyre's specialty. He took Roosevelt's temperature and his blood pressure, and that was about all he did. He didn't give Roosevelt a full examination for years. And finally, it was Mrs. Roosevelt and their daughter Anna, who realized that that the president's clothes were hanging on him. He had lost so much weight. He had lost 19 pounds in 1943 into 44. And they said, the president is really a sick man. You've got to take him to the hospital and have him checked out. And McIntyre said, it's only the after effects of flu in the winter. It's not serious. But they insisted. They took him to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and of course this was done very secretly, and there a heart specialist examined him and said he had progressive heart disease and he might not even live out the year. McIntyre wouldn't tell him. He lied to Roosevelt all of Roosevelt's life. So all Roosevelt knew is that he was not well. And he was getting progressively worse. But the only way he knew that was by their putting him on a diet and restricting his cigarette smoking and his drinking, one cocktail a day, five cigarettes a day. And the new doctor that took care of him put him on Digitalis, which was about the only thing they could do to stabilize his heart problem. All the drugs we have now just didn't exist. So he knew he was sick. But he also knew that the presidential election was coming up, and the Democrats had nobody else. He had so dominated the party and the country.
For so long.
Since 1933, that there was no other candidate out there. The Republicans wouldn't nominate Wilkie, and they looked around for somebody who was more steady in their way of thinking. And the one who wanted the job very much was Robert Taft, senator from Ohio, who had been known as Mr. Republican.
Mm-hmm.
He was very conservative, a very poor campaigner, and they knew that he couldn't possibly beat Roosevelt. So they went for Dewey, Tom Dewey, the governor of New York, who had been a very successful prosecutor as a district attorney in New York City. And Dewey, at 42, became the standard bearer for the Republicans.
Pretty young.
He was pretty young for the job, but after all, John Kennedy was 42 when he ran.
Yeah.
So it was the same age. The difference was in the quality of campaigning. Dewey, a prosecutor all his life, liked to yell at his audiences, and he was not really in rapport with audiences. He was stiff. He was like a suit without anybody in it. And reporters mocked him, saying that he even strutted when he was sitting down. That he was just a poor campaigner.
So you've got a guy, let me just ask, you've got a guy who's a governor of a popular state.
The biggest state in population then, yes.
And he was kind of from the more liberal wing, or not as liberal as some, but more liberal wing of the Republican Party.
Yes.
And he was stiff and awkward and didn't connect with people. So it sounds very familiar. Sounds a little bit like Mitt Romney.
It's a bit like Romney. About the only difference was that Romney is tall and does not have a little mustache like Dewey had. Dewey was short, and Alice Roosevelt Longworth, who was the surviving daughter of Theodore Roosevelt, and a Republican, of course, called Dewey the bridegroom on the wedding cake. And that really diminished him.
And I guess President Obama is not very similar to Franklin Roosevelt, although Roosevelt had been responsible for expanding the safety net for Americans in a way that had never been done before, and I guess President Obama has just done that with his healthcare system.
So yes, the equivalent, I think, other than in the early days of the New Deal with Social Security, is the fight in early 1944 in that election year over the GI Bill. The GI Bill, which I benefited from as a Korean War veteran, was the major piece of legislation affecting social mobility in our history since at least Social Security, probably more than that. And the Republicans were against it. They said all it will do is inculcate laziness. People can go out and find a job. They don't need any help from the GI Bill. They don't need to have their college paid for them. If they want to go to college, they can go to college.
47% of the American people believe that they're entitled. It sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
Yes, it does sound very familiar. And it took Roosevelt's twisting the arm of a representative from Georgia, who was a Democrat, to come vote on the GI Bill. And it passed by one vote.
Wow. One vote.
By one vote. And yet it may have been the most important piece of legislation in the 1940s. And we still benefit by it because home mortgages are often propped up by the GI Bill. And we keep renewing it for every new war. So soldiers coming back from Iran and Afghanistan and earlier Vietnam and before that Korea, in my case, benefited from the GI Bill. I earned my PhD after Korea because of that GI Bill.
We're talking with Stanley Weintraub, and his latest book of many is called Final Victory, FDR's Extraordinary World War II Presidential Campaign. Talk a little bit about the role that the president's wife, Eleanor, played in the campaign.
We have to think of Eleanor as FDR's legs. He couldn't get around much, but she could. And she did a lot of traveling for him. She had great rapport with labor, which was very important during the war because, after all, the wartime factories had to keep going, and they had to have good morale, and she went out to the mines and the factories and was a very useful support for him. But they were actually barely husband and wife anymore because Roosevelt had been involved in an affair in 1917 and 18 during World War One, when he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And Mrs. Roosevelt found out about it. Only when he became very ill And she had to read his letters and found the letters from his mistress. That ended their being physically husband and wife. And after that, it was a political arrangement. She agreed to be his wife and his political support, but they were never really together again after that. They slept in separate bedrooms. They lived separate lives. But people didn't know that. We talked earlier about how little people knew about the private lives of politicians. They thought that she was a loving wife and helpmeet and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a great lady. And by the way, her statue is also in the FDR Memorial
right.
in Washington.
Right. Well, what about their private life? I mean, did they go without relationships if they didn't have one with each other? Or did they have other relationships?
I don't think Eleanor had any other relationships. A number of women tried to latch on to her, lesbian women, and she rejected any kind of physical intimacy with them. But she was close to a number of women rather than to men. And Roosevelt actually saw Lucy Mercer, the woman he had been involved with, a few times during his presidency, and more at the end of his life. His daughter Anna arranged when Lucy, who had married late, became a widow, to have Lucy visit again. And Lucy was actually at his side when he had the cerebral hemorrhage that killed him in April 1945. She disappeared quickly. The press didn't know she was there, and people didn't know about it for years.
Well, as close to death as Roosevelt was when he was reelected in 1944, you would think that he would have made a very careful choice for his vice presidential running mate.
And he didn't. He didn't. He made the choice that was made turned out to be tremendously successful, but he didn't make it. He said that he thought other people might be qualified to be vice president. He was sympathetic toward Henry Wallace, who had been his third term vice president, but he knew that Wallace was too flaky to be renominated. No one would take him. Wallace, in fact, some rumor had it, and it was true, was consulting a guru named Madame Zenda. If that had come out in the press, of course, that would have been disastrous.
Just like Nancy Reagan did.
Yes, the Reagans consulted their own guru. So nothing really has changed in the presidency. But they had to find somebody. And Roosevelt suggested possibly William O. Douglas, a young justice of the Supreme Court. Douglas was very liberal. He was very well liked. But politicians knew that he was also a womanizer, and if that came out in the press, he'd be politically dead. And he really had quite a number of women in his life, and it was a good thing that he didn't get picked, because it would have come out finally. And Roosevelt suggested, what about James Burns, who was known as the assistant president? James Burns was a former senator and a former Supreme Court justice, and a very efficient guy. But Burns also was from South Carolina, was an open bigot as far as race relations were concerned, and a former Catholic. He had left the faith to marry a Protestant woman. That would have destroyed him in the urban Catholic centers of the Northeast. So he was out. And about the only one left, as the politician said, who fell between the cracks, was Senator Harry Truman of Missouri, who was from a border state, who was middle of the road, who had a very good reputation as the chairman of the Senate Investigating Committee on the War. And so Roosevelt said, okay, I'll sign a letter to the party chairman in which I recommend Douglas and Truman, and they can pick who they want. And he signed the letter, and Bob Hannigan the chairman of the Democratic Party came back to Roosevelt's secretary and he said, would you please rewrite this or retype this letter for me and put Truman's name first? And he did, got that done. And Truman became the vice presidential candidate, and he became a great president. And
didn't you say in your book that the secretary was very adept at signing the president's name?
Yes. We have no idea whether the president ever saw that again. His secretary may have signed it. But it worked out very well, even though Truman didn't want to be nominated. He was actually someone with no financial resources himself. In order to survive in Washington, which was very expensive, he had only a small senatorial salary. He put his wife on his payroll. She only made a couple of $1,000s a year, but it helped. And if that had been found out, it would have been bad for him. And as it was, she resisted losing her job. She didn't want to be Madam Vice President and jobless. Truman even had to mortgage his mother's farm in order to get additional money. So it's not like candidates today who are multimillionaires or more. Truman was not that at all.
He was a thousandaire.
Barely that, yes.
I just want to ask you one more thing about liberals. You know, so many presidents since FDR have claimed him as their, you know, their mentor, including Ronald Reagan. But everyone since, I don't know, since President Kennedy, has shunned the label of liberal.
It became a negative tag. And I think the problem is that the dictionary definition of liberal is not the same thing as the political definition of liberal. Liberal means that you're free and easy. And to be free and easy with public money became the negative connotation of liberal. And as a result, people stopped using it. The definition, the political definition would be very different. A liberal would be someone who has the public welfare in mind. And after all, the Constitution begins with lines about how it is to promote the general welfare of the nation. And this is being a liberal.
The public welfare in mind? What kind of a crazy idea is that?
Well, I think that there is a candidate who would object to that, yes. You have to do it on your own bootstraps.
That's right. Well, the book is called Final Victory, FDR's Extraordinary World War II Presidential Campaign. It's an amazing story of the fourth term election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and told incredibly well by my guest, Stanley Weintraub. Professor Weintraub, thank you so much for spending
some
time with us.
You're welcome. Glad to have a chance to talk with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. I want to thank my guest, Stanley Weintraub. His latest book, Final Victory, FDR's Extraordinary World War II Presidential Campaign. From the Bookshelf's producer is Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.